the Buddha would talk about the joy or the bliss of blamelessness, the bliss of blamelessness. So I want to explore that a little bit in this kind of recap talk, and also relationship of pleasure, pain, enjoyment, and relationship to ethics. Because if we're honest with ourselves, when we're not following the ethics, there's a part of that that's actually pleasurable, right? There's a part of it that we enjoy, otherwise we wouldn't do that. You know, the enjoyment of maybe taking something that's not ours, something that you may be misusing our sexual energy, maybe saying something that's untrue. There's a short-term pleasure in that. Of course, there's a long-term pain that comes from those actions. So learning how to kind of weigh that, to acknowledge that, okay, there's often that force of greed, of desire that often brings us into an unethical behavior. And what's the bliss of blamelessness when we are ethical? What is that actually like? The Buddha was speaking to a householder and talking about four kinds of bliss that people can feel in the proper season experience. Okay, can it be the bliss of having, you know, having something that we've maybe worked toward and developed wealth or you know, gotten objects of things that we were pleasurable about. There's a using of the use of that wealth, the use of those objects. There's a bliss of debtlessness, and then the final one is the bliss of blamelessness. The bliss of blamelessness. Now, this one, the Buddha spoke of it like this: that's when someone is endowed with the blameless bodily actions, blameless verbal actions, blameless mental actions. And when you act in a way that doesn't have any, no one can blame you for it. There's no sense of feeling ashamed of your actions because they're completely ethical. They're completely based in non-harm. There's a way that there's a blamelessness that comes from that. And there is a bliss that comes from that action or that way of being in the world. So bliss is an interesting word, right? We think of bliss and sometimes as this kind of ecstatic quality. But bliss also has this quality of simply abiding, like there's nothing needs to be changed in this moment. There's a sense of simply settling into, this is how things are. And I think we can all relate to this if we just reflect on times that we have actually been very ethical, very conscientious, very kind. And there's a way that's simply, we can just rest in ourselves. We don't have to justify our existence. We don't have to justify our actions. We don't have to be fearful. There's a sense of simply being present. Like, okay, I know what I did here was based in kindness, was based in connection. It was interesting that the Buddha talked about this. The verse that he did at the end of this little sutta is that knowing the bliss of debtlessness and recollecting the bliss of having, enjoying the bliss of wealth, the mortal then sees clearly with discernment, seeing clearly the wise ones, he knows both sides, that these are not worth 1/16th of the bliss of blamelessness. Okay, so that's a little awkwardly written, but there's basically saying that all these other blisses that we experience as householders, that's only 1/16th of the amount of bliss that comes from blamelessness, from living an ethical life, from our actions of our body, of our mind, of our words, be blameless. So the question is, how can we become more blameless? What's the pathway for that? Now, one of the most helpful roadmaps for this, to actually becoming more ethical, is actually the Eightfold Path. Okay, so Eightfold Path is one of those four noble truths. It's the last fold of that, or last foundation, or that truth. Eightfold Path has three elements. The middle part is actually ethical behavior, how we act in the world. The first part is the wisdom. The second part, or the third part, is the mindfulness, the quality of practice, of cultivation that allows us to see more and more clearly. So these three, when they work together, help us to become more and more blameless. Another way of saying it, it helps us integrate our wisdom and our understanding with how we show up in the world. We learn how to walk the talk, to actually become an upright person. Not because we're trying to fit into some external mold or some kind of external authority, as I spoke about a couple weeks ago. It's much more of that sense of internal authority, the internal knowing, that you know for yourself what is ethical. You know for yourself what causes harm. And as practitioners of meditation, we start to learn that inner sensitivity. We start to know when we're tricking ourselves, when we're trying to convince ourselves, just this once it's okay to take that thing. Just this once it's okay to speak something which isn't true. Just this once it's okay to cause harm. We can justify it through our minds. But there's a growing honesty in our hearts that actually becomes really essential for us to meet ourselves fully, to know ourselves in a deep way. Like the guided meditation, the words I was trying to point toward, is so often we don't want ourselves to be how we are. And there's something that's lacking. There's something that needs to change. There's something that needs to be more of this or less of that. It's almost an imbued way that we perceive, that we interpret life through our judgment, through our comparisons, through our inadequacy, or our grandiose, whatever it might be. And mindfulness has this quality of just meeting the moment just how it is, without trying to change it, without trying to alter it. And that very quality of change, of meeting the moment, it's counterintuitive because we think, you know, I have to do something with this moment. But actually see it in a clear way without any distortion, that in itself transforms us. For that to work, we have to be willing to see all aspects of ourselves. We have to be willing to see those parts that we rather not show anyone else, the parts that we judge about ourselves, that we loathe about ourselves. What happens is our heart starts to build this capacity to open to that, to feel that pain, to feel that part that we've cut our way from ourselves. We start to do that with other people, right? And as we do that, we can have that deep sense of honesty. So how does that relate to ethics, ethical behavior? We start to feel ourselves trying to justify. Like in times when I'm feeling myself bumping up against an ethical edge, I often notice there's a lot of internal dialogue. It's like, oh, it's okay this time. I'm kind of justifying why it's okay. I can explain it. I might have really good reasons. I may say, oh, I deserve this, or I do so much in other areas, whatever it might be, but I'm really talking myself into it. Other times when I'm ethical, when there's a clarity with that, there's not much to say. There's not much fanfare. There's not any need to justify. There's just kind of a settling. There's a sense of being grounded. Okay, that's that bliss of blamelessness. And as meditators, we get to learn that in a very internal way, to learn that inner compass of ethics, of morality, of virtue, whatever word you like. Now back to the Eightfold Path and how that's such a helpful practice as we use our meditation practice to see more and more clearly. From that place of clarity of seeing, wisdom starts to grow. Right? This is what's called right view or wise view. We're seeing the nature of things. We're seeing what causes suffering. We're seeing what causes the release of that suffering. And then our intention, our wise intention, wants to act from that, wants to connect our wisdom with our actual actions. That's why wise intention is kind of a linchpin in this whole process, because that's what comes between wise view and wise action. Wise action. Now it's interesting to reflect on our view that's behind our actions. So let's say our view, it's kind of an interesting word, but let's say it's our assumptions about how things are, it's our beliefs about how things are, It's kind of what our world is in that moment. So from coming from a place of insufficiency, of a sense of greed, of hatred, of delusion, kind of the three defilements we spoke about last year, that's going to lead to wise or to unwise intention. Right? My intention to act from a place of greed leads to certain actions. You know, the sense of coming from a harmfulness, trying to harm someone, that leads to a certain quality of action. Of desire, that's quality of action that comes from that. That's why the wise intentions, when our wise view is established, and there's many ways we can define that and explore it. One simple way to define it is the three characteristics. The characteristic that there is dukkha, there is suffering or insufficiency inherent in all experience, right? So we start to hold it a little bit more lightly. Then there's the noble, or not the noble truth, but the characteristic of impermanence, that things are always in flux, always changing. And we hold things as being solid, and the fact that they're changing, we experience distress with that when that change happens. And the third one is of self, of non-self, that this assumption of who we are as an isolated person, as an isolated being, is actually just a relative truth. It's a relative truth that helps us navigate the world, but yet it creates and holds the roots of our suffering. And learning to see through that frees up that suffering that's based in that illusion of self. We still know how to navigate the world and how to figure out things and have relationships, but yet there's a way that we don't take it so personally. And yet we can take full responsibility for our actions. So if that is established, that becomes a basis for wise view, which then flows into wise intention. Intention of goodwill, intention of renunciation, the intention of harmlessness. Right? So those three are the wise intentions. Next month, we're going to spend the whole month focusing on renunciation. Right? That's the next parami. So sila, or ethics, is in the context of these 10 paramis. So just imagine that if you have that short-term longing for pleasure, for something that's maybe unethical, the pleasure that comes from that, stealing that cookie or taking something which isn't yours or telling a falsehood, doing something like that, there's a short-term pleasure. That's where renunciation comes in. There's a sense of, okay, I want to trade the long-term happiness, the long-term bliss of blamelessness for this short-term pleasure. There's goodwill. It often feels good in the moment when we lash out, when we're really angry and we fire off that email or yell at a stranger, whatever it might be. There's a short-term kind of, okay, yeah, I really gave it to him. But the long-term pain of that really builds up over time. So that intention of harmlessness, of kindness. And coupled with that is goodwill. Not to harm another person. And then even a deeper expression is to actually have goodwill toward all beings, including ourselves. When we have those three established as our intention, ethics just naturally flow. Right? Our ethics come from that. That's why I think the Buddha put ethics, or that wise action section of the Eightfold Path, sandwiched between wise view and wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And of course, effort is another fold, wise effort. And that's how we're always kind of coming up against those touch points or those choice points. Do I act in a way that's ethical, that's kind, that's coming from a place of interconnection, of generosity, or coming from a place of disconnection, of selfishness, of isolation? And these choice points arise, and wise effort allows us to bring the energy to make a choice toward this blamelessness. So pleasure, pain, bliss, ethics, these are all interrelated. And we can have that short-term pleasure of being unethical, trading that for the long-term pain of those actions, the consequence of those actions. We can trade the short-term little discomfort of learning how to let go of what we want in an unethical way for that bliss of blamelessness. And as the Buddha said, that's the amount of that is much more than all these other types of pleasures that we can experience. We start to realize that the more we practice, the more we relax into our skin, the more grounded we are, there's a way we can hold ourselves up. We can become more and more present in our life, more and more connected. And people appreciate that. People sense that you are someone who's ethical. There's a joy that comes from that, a sense of trust, a sense of relaxing into that. The Buddha also said that these precepts or the being ethical has a boundless benefit for all beings and for yourself. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a moment or two, let those words settle. All right, thank you for your kind attention. So in a moment, we'll take a 5-minute break, coming back at, let's do 8:05, and we'll do some small group discussions, kind of diving into this topic, talking about your own exploration around ethics, around, you know, how do you, you know, trade that short-term pleasure for the long-term bliss of blamelessness. And just calling your attention to the Donna baskets. So there's two over there. One is for Seattle Insight. And Seattle Insight depends upon your generosity for us to continue to exist as an organization. Suggested amount for these kind of evenings is $5. Then there's a separate basket for myself, you know, for as a teacher, that your generosity helps me sustain my livelihood as a teacher in this tradition. And Ken, if you could put that link for those online, I appreciate that. All right, so let's come back in 5 minutes and we'll do some small group discussions. Okay, welcome back. Okay, so in a moment, we'll break up into some small groups, both online and here in person. And Ken, we'll be doing groups of 4 to 5 if the math works out. But let me structure the groups first. So the homework from last week was to notice both the pleasure and joy that arises around choices to be ethical or not, right? So it's kind of an honesty that, you know, there is pleasure that comes from, you know, cheating the system or kind of ways we kind of are slightly unethical. And what pleasure is kind of short term, you know, kind of based on those conditions, and what joy is long term, based on our actions. Remember, the Buddha talked about the only possessions we have is our actions. You know, how we intend and how we show up in the world, that's what actually carries forth from one moment to another throughout our lives. And then what's the role of internal versus external motivation around ethics? That's something I didn't do in the recap, but that sense of someone outside of us telling us how we should be, how we should be ethical. Sometimes that's helpful. Hi, Cheryl. Cheryl's taking a picture of me. It's hard not to notice that. Sorry, I'll pretend I don't notice that. So there's that external, like someone's taking a picture of you, and like, how should I get my best side or something like that? Versus that internalness around it. What's my internal integrity? Right? Both have their place, right? Like if I'm worried about what other people are going to think about me, sometimes that helps bolster my actions. But if we just have that, if no one's looking, then we just kind of are like wild animals. Or whatever is unethical for you. Okay, does that make sense? So talking about in your groups, and these groups, we're going to hold them what's said in there confidentially. It's a great practice in both sharing from your heart, your own experience. Don't put any kind of pretense or how you think you should be. Just try to just share in a sincere way. It's actually very helpful to learn to practice articulating what's like. What is your practice like? What are your insights like? What are your struggles like? So listening is as much of this group as speaking. Monitor how much time you speak, making sure you have space for everyone. We'll do about 20 minutes. And then some special instructions for those online. Sometimes we keep our cameras off, and there's, you know, sometimes really good reasons for that. But if you do have to have your camera off, just let the other group members know that that's what's going on, and you know, participate fully in the group. Okay, any questions about all that? Yes. Yes, talking about our thoughts around external or internal motivation or ethics. I'm just repeating it for those online. Also, you can look at that sense of pleasure, kind of that short-term pleasure versus long-term pleasure, you know, or that sense of bliss, of blamelessness. What is it like when you really are ethical? How does that change how you are in the world? Okay, so in the room, you can do groups of 4 to 5 is a good number. And we'll do this for 20 minutes. I'll give you a warning about 5 minutes till we're done. And those online, you should get an invitation to join a group in a moment. All right, so go ahead. Okay, welcome back. So we have some time now for any general questions about the topic of ethics, around your exploration of it. I'd be glad to dialogue with you. And if you're here in the room, you can come up here and grab the mic so they can hear you online. If you're online, you can just raise your virtual hand. Yeah, come on up, Dave.
Hoping you can clarify blamelessness for me a little bit. Because as someone who's kind of self-critical, I often, like if you were to gather 10 random people from around the world, from various cultures, and ask them if I'm to be blamed for something, maybe some people would blame me for being part of America. America does a lot of bad things. Hmm. Maybe the company I work for. Like blamelessness is kind of in the eye, or blame is in the eye of the beholder. So how can I be blameless? Except to myself, like I could not be blaming myself. Is that what's meant by blamelessness?
You might be overthinking it just a little bit. But basically, you know, we have our own kind of a sense of integrity. We have our own clarity or lack of clarity that generates our actions, right? So we act in a way, and, you know, we just do the best we can. You know, so there's that sense of, okay, from what I could see, this is the best action I could do. It's true that, you know, people might confront you or might say, hey, you're not being ethical, you've caused harm. So I think it's also important not to be kind of arrogant in our blamelessness, like, no, be in a sense of a shield or defensiveness around it, but being willing to listen to the impact of our actions. Because sometimes we might have really, from our perspective, really clear intentions. But yet the impact of our actions can cause harm because all of us have levels of delusion, of unclarity, of biases that we don't even realize that we're acting from, right? So we can't just use our own, that's why that external and internal together is really helpful, that willingness to listen to the external feedback around that. And it's true that, yes, some people might look at, if you're American, you're automatically unethical. You know, I think that's it's a bit of a stretch to say that as a blanket statement, just like anyone saying anyone is like that. You know, if you're like this, then everyone else is like that in that same way. But just, you know, do the best you can, you know, and be awake and present to listening to how those actions are actually perceived. You know, and sometimes you might do something that is, it is ethical, it is kind, and yet it's received in a way that's, you know, people feel hurt by that. So sometimes it's helpful to kind of get feedback from other people. Like Tori and I do that all the time. It's like we get feedback from students and we talk it through because sometimes it's really something we need to listen to and we need to honor the student's perspective and learn from it. And sometimes it just, you know, students get a little bit, they project on us, you know. And so that same thing is kind of learning, getting other people around you to kind of help you kind of check your thinking. You know, that's what the power of Sangha is. You can say, you know, I did this thing, I got this feedback, what do you all think? Was it ethical? Do I need to look at that? And if, you know, if they're honest and they're connected with you, they say, well, you might, you know, I can see how that might be a little bit off. You might want to look at that blind spot in you. So it's not like a clear-cut thing. It's really, there's a lot of gray area, a lot of nebulousness qualities to it. You know, and there's also the aspect of, I didn't mention this tonight, but I mentioned it last week, you know, forgiveness for our past actions. You know, if we carry a lot of guilt and a lot of remorse, some of that is helpful for us to learn from. But some of it just kind of keeps perpetuating this sense of a diminished sense of self. So especially if we have that tendency to feel like there's just off, you know, I just came into this world already condemned. I've already made a mistake just by showing up. If we kind of carry that attitude, we also need that cross-checking. We need people to say, you know, be easier on yourself. So it's like, I'm just trying to say that a lot of us, our internal discernment is a little bit distorted, a little bit unclear. And part of the practice is learning to become more and more clear, and Sangha helps us to find that clarity.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Dave. All right, what else? Everyone else got ethics down, no struggle at all. All right, Judith, go ahead.
Okay. Could you comment a little bit about the difference between thoughts and actions? Because sometimes I catch my mind having the most horrific thoughts. I mean, it's like I was like, how could you think that? You know, how could you even think that? But I'm not going to act on it. But I find myself feeling almost guilty and just hard on myself for even having the thought, you know, because it just seems so egotistical or so uncharitable or something. And other times I, you know, catch myself starting to react in a way that I used to react and then thinking, oh, I don't have to do that. And that feels good. But I mean, it does seem to me that that it's not healthy to be giving myself a hard time just because I have a crazy thought. And so anyway, could you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Because it's interesting with the Buddha, he would speak of action in kind of three ways. You know, one is our physical action, our action of our bodies. There's the action of our words. And this day and age, we have to include any kind of communication of writing letters, texting, direct messaging, all that. And then the final one, action, is of thought, of thinking, right? So he kind of said, okay, these are all actions. They all generate a certain consequence, there's intentionality behind them. Now, that being said, I think it's, someone said, I'm going to paraphrase it not very well, but we're not responsible for what arises in our minds, but we are responsible for how we act with it, what we do with it. Mm-hmm. And one distinction you might think about, there's a thought, and this is something that Chaz from IMS, kind of that Tweri shared with me, came up with that. You can have a thought is like almost like a discrete arising of something. It's like a sound. You hear the bell. You know, there's one sound arises, one thought arises, a sensation arises. Mm-hmm. Thinking is when we start to add to that thought, mm-hmm. right? We elaborate upon it, right? I remember being on a retreat at Cloud Mountain with Carol Wilson and Rodney Smith were teaching, and Carol was talking about someone brought her, like found a nest with some like little robin eggs. And her first thought was, I could just smash those. And she was just laughing that thought arose, right? So the thought arises. We have these thoughts arise that may seem crazy. It may seem like, wow, that's just like a, it's really macabre or whatever it might be. But what we do with it after that thought, that's what matters. Mm-hmm. Right? So that first thought arises, we just meet it, we notice it. If a thought arises and we start to kind of fantasize about it or elaborate upon that, mm-hmm. or judge ourselves from it, then that, you know, that's where we have more, we have to look at that part. But you know, the mind's going to come up, you know, with all kinds of things that just kind of pop up, whether it's coming out of our input from things we've watched or seen or heard, or maybe there's something kind of unwinding from ourselves. That's why I talked about at the, during the talk, or maybe it was during the meditation, just that sense of basic friendliness to our inner experience, mm-hmm. that willingness to open and see everything that's here. That's not the same thing as acting from everything that's here. That's really an important distinction. Because otherwise we get this kind of pressure that I can't think anything, because if I do, then I'm evil or something's wrong with me. But that just represses it, and it comes out in a bigger way other times. Like, oh, there's this thought. I'm going to smash those little robin eggs. Oh, that's interesting. That's really, oh, that's not what I'm going to do, but it's interesting that arose. Mm-hmm. So try to have more of that lightheartedness around it. You know, so notice it. You can notice the secondary reaction to it. But realize just because the thought arose doesn't mean anything about you. It's just how you meet that after that one moment. The thought is a momentary arising. The thinking is what we elaborate upon.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Thank you, Judith. Okay, Tish, let's go ahead with you. Trish.
Thanks, Tim. You know, so over the last week, like I noticed myself almost like hypervigilant to be ethical towards other people, because I don't think I ever want to be like blamed for doing anything wrong or accused of lying or things like that. But what I really noticed is I'm not ethical towards myself in a lot of ways. Like I was sharing with my group that I was sick the last week. And so, you know, like I went to the grocery store and I got all these, you know, comfort foods, like bags of chips and cookies and things I'm not committed to eating and I really didn't need, or, you know, it might just be like not handling an email when it comes in, when I'm kind of committed to keeping current on things. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about ethics towards ourselves, and how we might think of that. Or is that kind of more of another topic? Is that, I don't know. I don't know if I was getting that confused, but I was just noticing like how I treat others versus how I treat myself.
Yeah, when there's a big difference in that, I think that's something really helpful to look at. You know, in terms of ethics, I don't know if the Buddha explicitly talked about kind of that internal ethical relationship, but I think just as you said, it's really essential thing to look at, you know, treat ourselves in an equal way. We often find that when we become more and more accepting of ourselves, you know, and allowing of ourselves, we become less judgmental of ourselves, that naturally translates into our external relationships. You know, and if we other contrastly, like when someone's really judging you and being critical, you know they've got a really strong inner critic. They're judging themselves just as much, if not more so. You know, just the same thing. If we're really loving ourselves, that love goes externally too. So that's actually a powerful way to work with ethics, is how can I really include myself with that? I remember This is around ethics, but years ago when I was in group therapy, they had different kind of, you know, what do we call them? Self-care contracts. And one of them was not to harm myself or anyone else. And so, you know, I learned to do a lot of work around the times I would harm myself through my actions, being overworking myself or not taking care of myself. And then I would hold it the same way as if it caused external harm. And there's a lot of learning that came from that, to really hold ourselves in an equal way. The final thing I'll say about that is there's kind of a traditional test of someone's Brahma Vihara practice from I've heard about from the Visugi Magga, one of the commentary. Actually, Sharon Salzberg, I guess, encountered this, is that after you've done an extensive period of metta practice, sometimes the teacher will ask you a question. So if you try to forget this in case, so you can not know the answer. But basically it's a scenario, like let's say you are walking in the forest with your most dear friend on your right side and your most hated enemy on your left side. A bandit jumps out and says, okay, I'm going to kill one of you, but you get to choose which one. All right, so before practice, you might say, okay, here's a chance to get rid of my enemy, right? Or maybe I'm going to martyr myself, sacrifice myself. But if what happened with Sharon and if the practice has really worked, you realize you can't distinguish between those three categories of people. That the hated enemy, your dear friend, and yourself are all held in a very equal way. I mean, your heart is open to all of those. So I think, you know, certainly for yourself and anyone who find that there's this kind of discrepancy between external ethics and my internal, you know, self-harm or the way I hold myself, you know, turn toward that self-harm. Meet that with, and bring all the ethics to that. How can I have that? I like to talk about the precepts as internal harm also. You know, internal lying, internal stealing. Trying to bring that really deeply into that, your own experience. And I think you'll find that you won't have to be so vigilant outside because you'll be much more internalized in how you act in the world.
Yeah, I noticed over the last week that when I started like consciously trying to make a choice to treat myself like I treat others, and even though it was sometimes dealing with unpleasantness, how much joy there was in that. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting. So thank you.
Yeah, that's a nice, guidepost, right? When that joy arises. So go for that. That's a good feedback. Great questions. Anyone else like to come on up? Do you mind?
Hi, everyone. So talking about smashing things, we had like a very interesting conversation in our group about a stink bug. So there's this dilemma around killing or not killing a stink bug. So it's interesting because on one hand, if ethically you feel like you don't want to kill things, you might be like, I don't want to kill it. But then the recommendations are to kill it because it's bad for the environment. So it's kind of, I wonder if there's some dichotomy here in terms of like, I can choose to be ethical, but it might also be a little bit selfish. Mm. Like someone else should do the dirty work.
Mm.
So, and I think like that can expand to other examples, like killing someone in self-defense or, I don't know, but let's stick to the stink bug. So, I wonder, what do you think about that, being selfish and ethical at the same time?
And is it, some people think it's better for the environment to kill the stink bugs?
Well, I don't know the details, but apparently it's bad for the endemic species here, so... Oh.
Master gardeners instruct you to destroy stink bugs.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so the master gardeners instruct us to kill stink bugs.
Yeah, like the farmer's market.
Okay.
They're like, if you see this bug, destroy it immediately.
So, like, okay. If you don't kill it, technically... You don't kill it, it's alive. But if you do kill it, you help the other things that are alive.
Yeah.
And just to finish this question, recently I saw one on my desk. It's the cutest thing. It smells horribly if you touch it, but it's really cute. So I decided just to leave the room and be like, okay, please be away where I'm back, so I don't wanna smash you. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, these are really the really challenging things to integrate in our practice. You know, how do we come with that? And the way I would frame it basically is the precepts are framed as thou shall not kill. It's to undertake the training to refrain from. Right? So there is kind of this sense of the space to be a little bit more, to realize there's a lot of gray areas in life. Because if we really took it seriously, I would never kill anything. I wouldn't brush my teeth. I would never take antibiotics. It's like, okay, I don't want to kill the bacteria that are killing me. It's kind of that we can go all those different ways. So what I would suggest is just kind of sit with it yourself, kind of, because I'm not going to tell you this way or that way. I don't like to do that as a teacher because I think it's much better for us to see internally what makes sense. You know, there's times when I've had to kill insects, you know, different pests. And as I do that, I feel the pain of that. I feel the sorrow of taking something else's life. And it is, a lot of times, it is that kind of weighing of that. There's, I think we talked about this last week, the lesser harm. You know, what's the lesser harm that's happening there? And it's true that, you know, if you intend to kill something, that is breaking that precept. But sometimes that's what you need to do. If your house has termites, you know, here's a funny story. IMS, you know, the big meditation center, they had a problem with cockroaches. And they wanted to follow this precept and not kill them. So they hired some cockroach whisperers. Well, he thought about it anyway. They said, we're spiritual people. We can talk to our own cockroaches. But, you know, I don't think it worked out. So there's some language gap there. So they had to come up with probably a lethal solution there. So just you know, realize that sometimes you don't have any choice, you know, but to kill something. But just do it with your eyes open. You know, I think, because you can do it in a way of delight, like, oh, good, I get to crush these stink bugs. Or like, oh, okay, you know, you do it with a heavy heart. You do it with that, maybe say, sorry, I have to take your life. Kind of that kind of a relationship. That's what I do in my own life, in my own practice.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Austin, come on down. Price is right.
Can I spin the wheel?
You can.
I remember I told the story in my group of two quick ones. One was I was robbed at gunpoint at night, late at night. He put the gun to me. And now I look back and I'm grateful he didn't kill me because he really could have. So he broke one precept, but he kept another. And I think I share that story because sometimes I've been the beneficiary of other people keeping these precepts. And I know how good it feels. And just how I mentioned to the group, yes, there's kind of this connotation of what you give up and what's lost if you keep the precepts or the training to refrain from. But if you invert and you just think about how beautiful the world is and can be when we keep these precepts.
That's right.
Each of us individually and collectively, and how inspiring it is to be on this path of practice, knowing that there are people all around the world who are committed to non-harming. And having been the beneficiary of non-harming, how good it feels to offer that to somebody
That's
else
right.
in ways that are big and small. So I just thought I would share that.
Yeah, thank you, Austin. I think that's such a powerful way to relate to the precepts. It's just when you do, someone gives you that the act of generosity of they kind of have you in their power, but they care for you. You know, and when you do that to someone else, like finding a wallet and giving it to the person, and just, you know, they're so touched by that, you know, and that's what the Buddha spoke about, this immeasurableness of our generosity, of our kindness, of our ethics. It just kind of spreads, right? It spreads that, you know, your act of generosity, of ethics, you know, really touching someone, someone really seeing that, being connected with that, that spreads. As they act, they're more likely to be that way. Yeah. Thank you. All right, Edmund?
Hello. I have a practical question. I was wondering how would it be in terms of non-harming or not killing, no violence, in case of, for example, if President Putin would announce that he sees terrible injustice here in Seattle area about, you know, homeless people and everything, and he would say, okay, I will send my Marines here to Seattle and they will come invade here and fix all our problems here, you know, the way it's supposed to be. And he would actually do this and the Russian military would come here. And so I was wondering what would be the right action? You know, would you be fighting and killing invaders or what? From Buddhist point of view, kind of like what they're doing in Ukraine right now. You know, they just decided that, you know, Ukraine government is no good. And so I was wondering if the same would be happening here, let's say in Seattle, what would be actions? What would be the right way to act?
Yeah, it's a very difficult, painful question. And it kind of goes back to that, you know, the other question around the stink bugs is like, sometimes there is this, you know, someone else is harming you, you know, is it justified to protect yourself or to defend yourself? You know, I think it is. And I think it's, you know, again, there's that edge. It's like, how much do you do that? Can you have restraint, as much restraint as you can in that situation? Can you make, you know, as little harm as possible? You know, I think all those are real questions and really difficult questions. You know, some people would say, you know, and some of us may say, you know, it's absolutely no harm at all. I don't want to cause any harm. And the Buddha actually, there's a sutta called the Simile of the Saw. And in this sutta, he's talking to some monks about, my impression is that some of the monks were kind of being a little bit harsh in their speech. They're kind of causing some discord from that. And he kept trying to clarify that, okay, speaking from that hatred, that's where the problem is, right? When you act from a place of hatred, that's what causes the trouble. So you can be, you know, having an act of protection or defensiveness or kind of boundaries, you know, even to that extreme example you gave. But if you're able to do it without that hatred in the heart, you know, that's really, that's probably the best we can do in that moment, killing the stink bug without that hatred in the heart. And the Buddha, you know, kept trying to pound this point through to the point where he said, like, even if you're strapped down and these bandits are sawing your limbs from your body, not to have hatred in your heart. You might still be screaming and upset about that, but there's not the hatred. So that's the piece to look at, you know, in those kind of situations. Can I act in a way that doesn't have hatred? That's not creating that sense of other. There's still the sense of the real life actions of protection and clarity and whatever that shape that might take, but can I not have that hatred imbued in that? Okay, we've come close to our end of the night. This clock's got to be reset here. It's only 8:00. We have another hour. Just kidding. Okay, so next week we'll be moving from Sila to renunciation. And Carrie Peterson will be leading us off on that topic. I'll be here on the 8th. And then there's going to be Steve Wilhelm on the 15th and Tuari Salah the last Monday of the month. So you get 4 teachers this month. All right, so have a wonderful evening. And if you have a chance, you can help us put some of the stuff downstairs. And thank you again for your support for Sims and for myself through Donna.